This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hello, I'm Fiona Porter, and joining us in the Jodcast studio today is Stuart Ayres from the University of South Wales.
Hello, Fiona. Great to meet you.
Good to have you here. Now, you might be at the University of South Wales now, but I hear that you are in fact a triple Manchester graduate.
That's right. Did my first degree here and kept going until I got my PhD. Couldn't get enough.
Well, you managed to escape in the end.
Big rubber band snapped me back today.
So, can I ask a little bit about how your career's been going throughout that?
Yeah, so having done my PhD at Jodrell Bank, I was 5 years as a postdoctoral researcher at Keele University at John Moores, notionally working on infrared space observatory and Hubble Space Telescope data, but throughout that doing radio astronomy as well, which is where I started. Some of the stuff I'll talk about today relates to is radio astronomy. Mm. And then 8 years as a lecturer, working my way up to being a deputy head, associate head of school, and I've just realised it's about 10 years that I've been in university management, but still doing some teaching and still managed to do some research, funnily enough, from what I'd done in those previous roles. Hmm.
So you've managed to cover quite a broad spectrum of roles in that time, really?
Yes, and it's been interesting, and one of the challenges is not to move too far away from the academic core as you try to be more of a leadership role, so it's been interesting. Hmm.
So you gave a talk just shortly before this interview, in fact, which was about a rather interesting object that was first spotted in 1670. And you gave some really interesting historical context for that.
Yeah, so it's an interesting object. It's now known as CK Vul, so CK Vulpecula in the constellation of Vulpecula. And in the 1980s, that was related to this nova in Vulpecula that went off at the scene in 1670. So seen by some very well-known astronomers of the time, so Cassini made some observations, a guy called Johannes Hevelius, was involved in first identifying it as a new star in the sky. So literally, they were observing the sky and they saw this object at third magnitude, which is, a relatively bright star that they'd never seen before. In fact, it was reported as the Nova Subcapiti Cygni, which is the new object just below the head of Cygnus, the constellation. So they observed that back in the 1670s. In the 1980s, people were interested in classical novae, which are an interesting binary star, and whether they were the same group of stars as a very similar sort of object called dwarf novae, and whether they hibernated. So no classical nova had ever been seen to become a dwarf nova, and no dwarf nova had ever been seen to become a classical nova, even though their gross features, the sorts of stars they were, and the size of the binary system were very similar. So those people were looking to see if there are historical examples of classical novae to see if whether or not it had become a dwarf nova. So CK Vul was interesting because at that point it was 310 years since the outburst, so it could prove it was a classical nova and then discover whether or not it was now a dwarf nova, and that would constrain that theory. So that's what they were interested in. So they did some very painstaking work of figuring out where on the sky exactly Hevelius had observed it and Cassini had observed it, and obviously making their measurements of where they thought CK Vul was now, and with some various arguments because the accuracy of the position measurement they were able to derive from 1670 was not great. They were able to make reasonable argument that the same object, and since then we've developed our understandings and demonstrated yes, we're definitely the same object. Something happened in 1670 to cause this star to brighten to third magnitude, and that's the same thing that we're observing now with modern instruments.
It was really quite interesting. You gave a comparison between the sort of reports that are made when an object like this is discovered. Well, it was in the time in the 90s. Versus how it was reported in the 1670s, and it was actually surprisingly similar.
Yeah, and you're doing the same job. So the example I showed in the 90s, which you'd still, the technology about how we do that is improved and speeded up and often automated now, but you're saying the same thing. You need to know how bright it is, where it is in the sky, get some confirmation from other people. And there's a formal way of doing that with what were called IOU circulars, which were literally physical telegrams that arrived in the observatory because that was the fastest way of doing it. And one thing I didn't mention was the example I'd shown was observed on the 19th of February and the confirmation came around on the 20th of February, so 24 hours to confirm the discovery. Now we'll do it in 24 minutes or 24 seconds. In the 1600s, it was, the discoverer spotted it on the 20th of July. Slightly later in the month, he went off to some assembly of scientists in Paris and told them about it. And then later on in the month, they all confirmed the observations, making their own observations. So in that case, it took days, if not weeks, to confirm what they'd seen and get other people to observe it, or confer and say they've all observed the same thing. And it was ultimately published in an annual publication. So again, we might publish within hours or days, but those very fast, rapid moving new objects, they were working as quickly as they could, been publishing it within 12 months. So the whole acceleration of how we do things has changed as well, of course. But the overall process is the same. You know, their language seems odd to us because it's old fashioned, I'm assuming English translated from the French at the time, but it does all the same things. It says who else has seen it, it says where it is, it says how bright it is. So that's where, you know, the Nova Subcapiti Cygni came from, the original publication saying this is a new object just below the head of the swan. I think it's a Via Lactae, which is in the Milky Way. So.
Because, of course, at the time, the language of science was very much Latin.
Absolutely. So that whole paper, the other interesting thing about that paper is, you know, it's a paper about all those stars, there's a catalogue of stars, but it also happens to have an observation of Saturn's rings as well on the same paper, which was done by the same person. So he just wrote down all the things he'd done since the last time something had been published, and that happened to be included in observation, right?
I mean, I suppose if you're only being published once a year, then you can sort of go, oh, and I did this, and I did that.
That's right. These are the interesting things I've done this year. Because the great thing about now is that's all, you can find that paper. It's been scanned in by somebody, it's all digitized. You can find that in its original form. So it's fascinating to find that when I was just exploring that, about the origin of the... So my collaborator always used this phrase, Nova Subcapiti Cygni, and I thought, where has that come from? And when I tracked it down, it was there in his table of results.
So. I think... For any of our listeners who speak Latin, if there are any of you out there who want to have a look at this, I'll see about attaching a link to the interview notes so you can have a little look at the original Latin paper yourself. So moving from history back on to the more modern research of Nova Subcapiti Cygni.
Yes, so one of the things I talked about was why originally we were interested in it. So my research started in classical novae when I was a student here, and the person I was working with after that was also interested in that. So we were interested in this object because it might be a link between classical novae and dwarf novae. Now, it turns out when you look at how this object behaved in the 1670s and some of its other contemporary features that we observe, then it almost certainly isn't a classical novae. So not least... It was seen to brighten in 1670. It was then seen to brighten again in 1671. And in that occasion, because they were aware there might be an interesting object there, they were being more attentive to it. And they saw it brighten as well as fade. Now, classical novae brighten in hours, you know, and until the advent of modern continuous robotic observations of these objects, we never had detected the rise phase. In fact, in many cases, we couldn't even detect it before it brightened. So the fact that there was a slow rise phase, which was as slow as the subsequent decline... And the fact that it did that in 1670, 1671, and then appeared more faintly in 1672, both of those argue against it being a classical nova. So that even, you know, that was known in 1985, but to be fair, in 1985 we didn't understand classical novae quite so well. So, you know, there was also an argument that we couldn't be sure until we'd done the work. In the 2000s, one of the things I showed was observations published in 2015, which were a fantastic piece of work by Kaminsky, with spectra of molecular lines over a very wide range of frequencies. So 27 different molecules, which is, anybody who knows anything about this, is an enormous number of molecules to detect, so you're in one set of spectrum, with different isotopes in those molecules. So there are actually 37 different isotopic species altogether in there. Isotopes that you don't get from classical novae. So again, that was a more modern explanation that definitely wasn't the classical nova, though by that point we pretty much convinced ourselves.
Still doesn't hurt to have a little bit of backup, does it?
No, and it was how you explored that, having, you know, it told you, pointed to other possibilities as well. Mm. And one of the things I talked about in the talk was the fact that we've gone through a whole list of possible objects that could brighten in this way as it did in the 1670s, and gradually excluded them. So there's a whole load of other sorts of novae, supernovae that we've gradually excluded. There's something called a very late thermal pulse object, which again I've done a lot of work on. So a very late thermal pulse object is something that happens in, we think, about 20% of main sequence stars. So about 20% of stars like the Sun do this. The Sun could do it at a later point in its evolution. These stars, when they are starting to become a white dwarf, have a residual layer of helium and hydrogen that reignites and sends them back to the giant part of their evolution. We call them born-again giants. So it could have been one of those, but again, there's a whole load of features that rule that out. So at the moment, we're classifying it into this rather small group known as red novae. So small in the sense there's not many of them. We know a handful, maybe 10. But it's also quite a large group in the sense that there's quite a range of different characteristics. So it may actually be that there's more than one type of star in there.
Right.
But they become bright and then they go very red. As opposed to classical novae, which become bright and go very blue. Okay, so that's why they're called red novae. It's not a very imaginative name, but it just describes them.
That's astronomy for you, isn't it?
Yeah. So the best explanation we've got of those over the range is that they're a merger between two stars, or perhaps a star ingesting a planet around it. And we've kind of fitted this object into that range of possibilities there. So what we were claiming is this is a white dwarf and a brown dwarf colliding. So a white dwarf has a mass of around about the Sun, maybe a bit less, but compressed into the volume of the Earth. A brown dwarf actually will be much bigger, even though it's less massive, because it's kind of a failed star or a very large bit, you know, what you would get if Jupiter was much more massive, but not big enough to be a star. So actually, although it's less massive, it's actually a bit bigger than the white dwarf and fluffy. So those two things interacting and colliding in 1670 might have given what we saw then and what we now see. Yeah, so we've been working on this for a few years, including one of our papers literally going through all the possibilities and knocking them off. So trying to figure it out. And then the same piece of work that showed all those molecules also observed the dust, so the tiny particles of solid material around the star, and demonstrated that that dust existed at a temperature of 15 Kelvin. So that's very cold, obviously, by any normal terrestrial standards, but it's not an unusual temperature for solid dust particles to be in space. And the observations of that had been with a telescope that didn't have sufficient resolution to tell you where it was and how it was, just that it was associated with the star. So what we did was use the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, which is an international European Southern Observatory system that the people here in Manchester help to operate. And we used that to image that cold dust around the object and found some quite complicated structures there that are very similar, in my mind, to the things we see in planetary nebulae and pre-planetary nebulae. So a planetary nebula is what you get when certain stars below about 8 solar masses. So, for example, the Sun get to the end of their life and they eject the envelope of the gaseous envelope, and it forms very elaborate structures that we're still trying to understand how those formed. But what we see with the ALMA around this object is very similar elaborate structures. And those structures in planetary nebulae are usually attributed to some form of binary system, so more than one star in the centre, two or more stars in the centre that shape planetary nebulae as they are formed. So that indicates that, you know, there was probably a binary system there when we started in 1670, and that therefore allows the possibility of a merger. Now, to get mergers, you need to disrupt the system. You need to disrupt the system, and a binary system, a genuinely binary system, two similar masses going around each other, is actually very stable. But if you add another object, so say another star or a large planet, that then allows you interactions which would cause the thing to become unstable. So it seems likely that if it is a stellar merger and a disruption of the system, there must be other objects in there. And we have a couple of very high proper motion objects in the field of view. So in other words, two compact bright things that are moving across the sky quite quickly. And measurements have shown that if you track those two back, they come to the same point in the middle of the system where we think the star is in 1670. So that seems likely that you're seeing a disrupted multiple system. But we haven't got observations to confirm that. For example, we'd like to know what those two ejected objects are. You know, and at the moment, they're just providing some bright light in the hydrogen, but we don't know anything else about them. And they're moving quite quickly.
Are there any theories about what they might be? Could they be, for example, is there anything to rule out whether they might be a third star? Because I certainly know that trinary systems are possible, or absolutely, a large planet. Absolutely.
In fact, lots of multiple systems are out there. They're not a star in the sense of being, say, a star like the Sun, because this observation we made would have detected that and demonstrated that. They could be compact brown dwarf systems, perhaps with something around them to shroud them, but a brown dwarf system or a planet of some sort. But something more compact than just a ball of gas. It's possible that a compact ball of gas would maintain its identity over 350 years, but it seems odd that that would be the only, you know, you get a couple of those going in that direction. So my current thinking is if we have a good look at those and try and figure out if they could be ejected planets or ejected brown dwarfs, that would then give us a handle on the system and potentially allow us to measure. If you measure the masses of those, then it also gives you some way of getting into the dynamics of what happened in the 1670s.
Right.
The other challenge for this object is, because it is quite unusual, you have to think about, well, what else does it tell us about astronomy? So that understanding, if they've actually got an example, we can understand what happens when a multiple system disrupts. There's lots of theories about that, which are very well-founded and well-constrained theories in terms of, you know, it's well-understood physics, it's Newton's laws, essentially, and a bit of gas dynamics. Actually finding examples of where it's happened, there aren't many of them, so this could be an example of that, and of course with a long time scale in terms of history observation, so that's interesting as well.
I suppose it's very rare to be able to have an object which you can follow up on over quite that length of time.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, yes, there's a handful of them. A lot of my work has been on following objects for several years to understand what's going on. So certain parts of stellar astronomy allow you to do that, but certainly not centuries. And I guess guess the famous one would be the Crab Pulsar, the Crab Nebula, and the supernova in...
That was originally...
1054, I think. You know, which...
Yeah, the Chinese astronomers, I believe, spotted that one.
Right, so it's reported by the Chinese astronomers when they were recording those things. So, but there's relatively few objects, absolutely, where you can go, okay, we saw something in older times, and we can use that to find something out about now.
And naturally, a lot of these things start off more or less invisible to us, so there's a degree of luck in spotting one of these things when they happen.
And that's changed a lot. So historically, these objects were detected by, not in the 1600s, I'm talking about the 1900s, and then were detected by amateur astronomers. And certainly in the 1980s, 1990s, it was amateur astronomers who were interested. They would have a binoculars and they'd find these things and report it. So the example I showed you was probably a well-equipped amateur astronomer with telescopes doing these observations, and then we'd respond to that. Increasingly, there's still a role for amateur astronomers in that, but increasingly, of course, we've now got automated surveys that go down to very faint brightnesses, 18th or 20th or 24th magnitude on a regular basis, and they often will identify these things beforehand. So we now have, for example, some observations of the rise of classical novae from their faint state to their bright state, which,
Historically, would have needed an enormous amount of luck to pull off.
Absolutely. Because you wouldn't know, it didn't know there was anything there until it reached its bright state. So we're now, because they're systematically observing whole bits of the sky on a regular cadence. So I think there's a paper we published a few years ago, which was, I think, every 20 minutes was being observed. So we actually saw the rise to peak. We were able to say something about that. But that's only become possible in the last few years. And at the moment, only on a very small number of cases, because it's not usually what they're looking. It's not what they're designed to observe. So it's just luck if they happen to be pointing in the right direction at the right time. That will change, because now we're going down to 24th magnitude, you know, several times a week or whatever it will be with some of the large surveys. So the last thing I talked about was what we might do next. So obviously we've got these observations of this object, and it's pointing to a stellar merger in the 1670s. The structures we're seeing now, like Planetary Nebulae, all kind of support that, but that bit's a little bit speculative now. So there's a few ideas I've got about what we do next. One is to just explore these two ejected objects and just try and understand those a bit more, see if they aren't brown dwarfs or whatever they might be, because that will give us an idea of what system was before and therefore what must have happened. We also want to go back and examine the data in a bit more detail, because we've got some information about the velocity. It took me a bit of time to find somebody who could work with me on that, because it's not my area of expertise. So we want to go back and have a look at the velocity structures of the gas and how that's evolving. That, again, might tell us something about what's driving it and therefore what happened. Yeah, so that those are the two sort of areas of interest for me. There's a couple more esoteric parts, but those are the two things I think we'd find out. Oh, and the last thing we might be able to do is measure if there is a disky structure in the middle. You, in principle, be able to measure how that's rotating, and from that work out the mass of what's in the middle. And if it's what we think it is, it'll be a certain mass. If it turns out to be a completely different mass, yet again, we'll have to go back to the drawing board.
Keep on crossing out all those ideas, eh? But still, another thing which is good, just to have a potential method of confirmation on.
Yes, just got to persuade the telescope panel to give us the time to observe it.
Well, best of luck. And if that elastic band does ever snap you back to Manchester again, and you've gotten a bit more in the way of results on it, we'd love to hear from you again.
Thank you. Fantastic to talk to you, Fiona. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. Bye for now.